Good afternoon. Thank you for joining us here at the Heritage Foundation. I'm John Hilbolt, Director of Lectures and Seminars, and it's my privilege to welcome you to our Lewis Lehrman Auditorium. And we, of course, welcome those who are joining us on the heritage.org website. We would ask those in the room to please check that cell phones and other electronic devices have been turned off as a courtesy to our guest. And remind our internet viewers that questions or comments can be submitted to us at any time, simply emailing speaker@heritage.org. We are pleased today to co-host this special book event with the Religious Freedom Coalition. I thank Bill Murray as chairman of that coalition for inviting our guests to come and join us here at Heritage and allowing us to co-sponsor this program. The Religious Freedom Coalition seeks to inform the Congress and the general public of alternatives to the liberal agenda. The coalition also holds the Bible as being the highest standard to which government can be held and maintains that the church, not big government, is the answer to most social problems. Our special guest this afternoon is Dr. Mark Dury. Dr. Dury is a theologian, human rights activist, and vicar of St. Mary's Anglican Church in Caulfield, Victoria, Australia. He has published many articles and books on the language and culture of the Akanese, Christian-Muslim relations, and religious freedom. He is a graduate of Australia's National University and the Australian College of Theology. He has held visiting appointments at the University of Leiden, MIT, UCLA, and Stanford. And in 1992, he was elected a Fellow of the Australian Academy of the Humanities. Please join me in welcoming our special guest, Dr. Mark Dury. Dr. Dury.
Thank you, John. It is indeed an honor, privilege to be speaking here today. And I do wish to acknowledge the hospitality and support of the Religious Freedom Coalition in organizing this event. Well, what are the three choices? Why is the concept of the three choices important for faith religions and faith relations in the world today? In 2006, when Pope Benedict gave his now famous Regensburg lecture, he quoted Emperor Manuel II Palaeologus, who spoke of Muhammad's command, and he quoted, command to spread the sword by the sword the faith he preached. Now, the Pope's comments elicited a sharp reaction from Muslims all over the world. Some lost their lives in the reactions. One of the most interesting responses was from Sheikh Abdul Aziz al-Sheikh, Grand Mufti of Saudi Arabia, who issued a press release stating that Islam was not spread by violence. He argued that it is false to say that Islam was spread by violence, by the sword, because, he said, infidels had a third choice. The first choice was Islam, the second was the sword, but the third was, as he explained it, to surrender and pay tax, and they will be allowed to remain in their land, observing their religion, under the protection of Muslims. The Grand Mufti referred his readers to the example of Muhammad. He said, those who read the Quran and the Sunnah, the example and the teaching of Muhammad, can understand the facts. Indeed, the doctrine of the three choices does go back to the teaching of Muhammad, who taught his followers, and I quote, he said, fight in the name of Allah and in the way of Allah. Fight against those who disbelieve in Allah. When you meet your enemies, invite them to three courses of action. Invite them to Islam. If they respond to you, accept it from them and desist from fighting against them. That's the first choice. Then he introduces the third choice. If they refuse to accept Islam, demand from them the tribute, the tax. If they agree to pay, accept it from them and hold off your hands. And then Muhammad mentioned the second choice. If they refuse to pay the tax, seek Allah's help and fight them. Now, the order of the choices may be varied in the different sources, but they are always the same three: Islam, the sword, or surrender. The question of whether Islam was and is spread by the sword is, of course, one of the core contested ideological issues of our world today. It preoccupies minds even when they don't realize they're being preoccupied by it. It relates to the question of how does religion and violence relate? How can you link them up? What is the religious component in terrorism or other forms of violence involving Islam? Well, if the Grand Mufti is correct, and you would think that the most senior legal and religious authority in Saudi Arabia would know something about Islam, and if he's correct, and the key plank in the defence against the accusation of spreading faith by violence is the third option of surrender to Islam, accepting Islamic rule and life under the Sharia, then it is a matter of the greatest interest for the world what this third choice entails. What does it mean to take the third choice? My book, The Third Choice, Islam, Dimitude and Freedom, is devoted to answering this question. It analyses and explains the situation of non-Muslims living under Islamic rule. Islamic calls non-Muslims who live under the political dominance of Muslims the dhimmis. The conditions which Sharia law determines from them are sometimes described as dhimmitude. Now, the stories of the dhimmis and dhimmitude is, I believe, one of the most pressing political, spiritual issues facing the world today. This is the issue highlighted by the great scholar William Montgomery Watt in the last decade of the 20th century. He wrote, "There are undoubtedly some Islamic states which treat non-Muslim citizens in ways which can only be described as oppressive. It is of the utmost importance that Muslim jurists should consider whether such treatment of non-Muslims is in accordance with the Sharia or contrary to it. More generally, does the Sharia allow Muslims to live peacefully with non-Muslims in the one world? To have an answer to these questions," Watt said, "may be a matter of urgency in a few years' time." One of the challenges which I explain and outline in my book is that despite the urgency of the question, the treatment of non-Muslims under Islamic rule is a subject which is steeped in silence and denial. In writing this book, I've essentially done three things. First is to delve deep into Islam itself, laying bare its inner workings and explaining for the benefit of non-Muslims how Islam functions as a spiritual and ideological system. This includes a careful examination of the contribution Muhammad himself made to the faith he founded. The next thing I do is to explore and explain the classical provisions of Sharia law for the treatment of non-Muslims under Muslim rule. I have surveyed dozens of commentaries of the Quran, working from the original Arabic, legal textbooks, and historical accounts by both Muslims and non-Muslims to provide an analysis of the dhimmi condition. Finally, I take these theological, legal, and historical underpinnings and explain how they shape and indeed profoundly determine many aspects of interactions between Muslims and non-Muslims in the world today. The third choice offers a narrative or a framework grounded in history and theology for understanding this key aspect of contemporary geopolitics. Now, while painstakingly gathering the materials for the third choice, I've also been sitting on the wall and watching, like a fly, the proverbial fly on the wall of the world. I paid attention when President Bush declared immediately after 9/11 that Islam is a religion of peace. I noted when President Sarkozy declared that Islam is one of the greatest and most beautiful civilizations the world has known. And when President Obama spoke extensively in Cairo of what he called Western civilization's debt to Islam. I have been observing the tendency of Western leaders to adopt a tone of grateful inferiority and praise for Islam. The key to this phenomenon, the gratitude and the sense of inferiority, I argue in this book, lies in the dhimma, the covenant of surrender which determines Islam's treatment of non-Muslims and delineates the place of non-Muslims living under Islamic rule. One of the many incidents which attracted my attention over the years was an art exhibition in Sydney. It was an exhibition of Islamic art, and the owner of this collection, David Khalili, is a Jew of Iranian extraction. Now extremely wealthy and honoured by a number of universities with honorary degrees, he devotes his life to promoting positive regard for Islam in the West. It is a remarkable thing because the Iranians' treatment of Jews under the dhimma system was particularly cruel and demeaning. But what most interested me about David Khalili were his statements about Islam. For example, he was asked on the ABC, the Australian Broadcasting Commission's radio program, he was asked whether his work to present Islamic art might help Muslims to understand that Jews are not inferior. He responded, "I don't think there is a question of the Jews being inferior. I don't think that thought has ever crossed any Muslim's mind." He went on to say, and I quote, "Virtually one-third of the Quran, Surah Al-Baqarah, is in praise of the two other religions, Judaism and Christianity. I don't think that's a question at all. I think the problem is ignorance amongst people, and I can say on your program that I believe the biggest and the real weapon of mass destruction is ignorance. If people try to understand their culture, their religion, their way of life, then they start to respect each other." Now, what struck me about Khalili's statements uttered to an Australian reporter were that in a number of key respects, they were utterly and completely false. For example, Surah 2, Al-Baqarah, comprises 7% of the Quran, not a third. And far from being in praise of Christianity and Judaism, it largely consists of a long litany of retorts given to the Jews of Medina as a kind of prologue to Muhammad's expulsion of them from the city and ultimately the destruction of the final tribe, the Bani Quraiza. Included in Surah 2 is a verse which says that Allah changed Jews into apes, verse 65, another which alleges that the Jews forged their scriptures, verse 79, to name but a few of the many quite anti-Jewish libels in the chapter. There is, it must be admitted, a verse that speaks positively of the Jews. Now, such events, of which I've collected many examples over the years, raise troubling questions. I'm familiar from my pastoral ministry with the denial of the battered woman, who praises her abusive partner despite all his cruelty to her. She feels grateful. The idea that victims praise their oppressors is hardly new. The question which David Khalili's strange devotion to presenting a positive regard for Islam raises is why? What abuse led to this denial? In the third choice, I give an answer of why. At the heart of the book is an analysis of the Dhimma Pact itself, which in Sharia law is the covenant or the contract under which non-Muslims were considered to be living. The conditions of the Dhimma covenant, this agreement, treat non-Muslims as people whose lives would have been forfeit if Muslims had not spared them. The annual jizya head tax paid by Dhimmi males is described by authoritative Islamic sources, and I've consulted over 70 commentaries, as a redemption paid by Dhimmis in return for their life. Or as one commentator put it, this compensates Muslims for their duties of taking slaves, killing and plundering the infidels. Al-Hidayah, a highly regarded Hanafi legal manual from the 12th century, explains that the jizya tax payment is a payment, a redemption against future jihad attack. It says, jizya is a substitute for destruction in respect of the infidels, but it is a substitute for destruction with regard to the future, not with regard to the past, because infidels are liable to be put to death only in the future in consequence of future war. Or as William Eaton explained in 1799 in his compendious survey of the Turkish Empire, he said the very words of their formulary given to Christian subjects on their paying the capitation tax, that's the jizya, import that the sum of money received is taken as compensation for their being permitted to wear their heads that year. In researching this book, I unearthed the powerful symbolism of the annual tax payment ritual, the jizya payment, which Dhimmi males were required to undergo all over the Muslim world until modern times. This payment ritual involved a blow on the neck, in some versions two blows on the neck, one on the back and one on the side. And also in some versions a form of ritual strangulation, signifying that the Dhimmi is playing for his very life, rescuing his head by this tax. I was able to find more than about 30 references to the blow on the neck, for example, from Morocco to Bukhara, from Yemen to Istanbul, from the 9th to the 20th centuries, from Muslim and non-Muslim sources alike. Let me read one example. This one is from Morocco, and the scholar is Al-Mahili, a Moroccan jurist from the 15th century. He writes, "On the day of payment, the Dhimmi shall be assembled in a public place, like the souk. They should be standing there waiting in the lowest and the dirtiest place. The acting officials representing the law shall be placed above them and shall adopt a threatening attitude so that it seems to them as well as to the others that our object is to degrade them by pretending to take their possessions. they will realize that we are doing them a favor in accepting from them the jizya and letting them go free. They then shall be dragged one by one to the officer responsible for the exacting of payment. When paying, the dhimmi will receive a blow and will be thrown aside, so that he will think he has escaped the sword through this. This is the way that the friends of the Lord, that is, of Muhammad, of the first and the last generations, will act towards their infidel enemies, for might belongs to Allah, to his prophet, and to the believers. This is from the 15th century. It's very striking in Morocco because there was an American ship's captain who was shipwrecked in Morocco and enslaved and eventually ransomed. But he describes this ceremony at the beginning of the 19th century, and then a visiting Italian Jew describes it in the very closing years of the 19th century. So it continued virtually unchanged century after century. Imagine if after the Normans had conquered England, they required the Anglo-Saxons to line up on every village green each year and redeem their heads as they handed over their tribute, being ritually stabbed in the heart to show that they have escaped death through this tax. Imagine also that this system, which began in 1066, will need to run for another 400 years before it reaches the time period which applied to the Jews in Morocco and Christians and Jews in Damascus or Baghdad or other parts of the Muslim world. And it'll only stop through invasion of England by forces from other countries. The dhimma system was designed to reduce the non-Muslim communities it dominated, and many legal disabilities had this effect. For example, one of the rules of the dhimma pact is that non-Muslims are not allowed to give witness in court. This affects Muslims in Christians and others in Muslim countries today. It means that if someone takes a case against you, a Muslim takes a case against you and you're not a Muslim, you're unable to defend yourself. Another principle which is widely reported in the sources is that Muslims and non-Muslims should look different. So non-Muslims should wear different clothing, a distinctive belt. The yellow patch that the Nazis used for the Jews was invented in the medieval period for the Jews of Islam. The scholar Ibn al-Qayyim, in his book on the laws of the dhimma, cites a hadith, the tradition of Muhammad, in support of this principle of being distinct. Muhammad said, "I've been sent with the sword in my hand to command people to worship Allah and associate no partners with him. I command you to belittle and subjugate those who disobey me, and here's the key part, for those who look alike are of the same." The 18th century Moroccan commentator, in his commentary of the Quran, Ibn Ajiba, describes its purpose, the purpose of the dhimma system, in one of the many passages that have been unearthed, translated and published for the first time in this book. He calls this system of the dhimma a killing of the soul. He writes, "The dhimmi is commanded to put his soul, good fortune and desires to death. Above all, he should kill the love of life, leadership and honour. The dhimmi is to invert the longings of his soul. He is to load it down more heavily than it can bear until it is completely submissive. Thereafter, nothing will be unbearable for him. He will be indifferent to subjugation or might. Poverty and wealth will be the same to him. Praise and insult will be the same. Preventing and yielding will be the same. Lost and found will be the same. And then when all things are the same, the soul of the dhimmi will be submissive and yield willingly what it should give." Ibn Ajiba died in 1809. In essence, non-Muslims are regarded in classical Islamic jurisprudence as people who owe their lives to their Muslim conquerors. They are expected to adopt an attitude of gratitude and humble inferiority. Al-Mawardi said this, that the jizya is to be exacted as a remuneration. He said it's either it's exacted with contempt or it is a sign of mildness. And these represent the two psychological characteristics that dhimmis are expected to show. One is of inferiority and the other is of gratitude. Now, I argue that these twin psychological characteristics, these expectations of gratitude and inferiority, are increasingly shaping contemporary geopolitics and interfaith relations. President Bush's praise for Islam or President Obama's extensive references to the world's debt to Islam reflect this underlying worldview of gratitude and inferiority. Many contemporary responses to Islam appear to be but projections of the inner ancient logic of the dhimma system. The third choice is also concerned with the wounds to the souls of non-Muslims, and indeed of Muslims as well, caused by centuries of this asymmetrical relationship, this abuse. I devote a whole chapter in the book to discussing the persecution or discrimination against non-Muslims in Muslim nations today, arguing that in every single particular where non-Muslims suffer disabilities in Muslim countries, this follows principles that are clearly laid out in the Sharia. There is a deep resistance in Western cultures today to take theology seriously. By and large, we have forgotten how to apply theological constructs to everyday life. Many hold quite incompatible ideas together in their minds, as if they could all be true. One is that all religions are essentially the same. Some speak of universal values and all worshipping the same God. Another idea is that religion is essentially irrelevant and personal. Another widespread idea is that religion is essentially pernicious, a bad influence, and must inevitably give way to other better ideas. And there's also a great fear of sounding and being intolerant. Well, faith is not going to go away as a major influence on world affairs. I believe the key to harmony, or one key to harmony in the century ahead, lies in understanding distinctions of religions. The West can no longer afford to lull itself to sleep by assuming that religions are all essentially the same, or that religion does not matter, or that religious ideology is not a cause for anything. Religious illiteracy is no panacea for the world's ills. We need the ability to think critically about faith, to analyze it, and to understand its distinctive and varied contributions on everyday life. For this reason, one of the things I also do in the third choice is to make a case that faith matters, and to explain how it matters, and why it needs to be understood and interacted with in ideological terms, if we are to understand the world today. This book has been, for me personally, an incredibly hard one to write. It speaks of the most profound and deeply affecting themes of personal identity and spiritual history, as well as about geopolitics and the future destiny of nations, themes which, as I've said, have been shrouded in confusion and denial. What is happening in the world today? Are we paying attention? Does our worldview permit us to take in the facts that come our way? Will Bernard Lewis be proved correct when he prophesied that some countries in Europe will become majority Muslim in the next half century? The third choice provides resources for understanding what such a future might look like, at least for non-Muslims, if the traditional provisions of Sharia law are successfully applied under a Muslim majority in those nations. Finally, I draw your attention to the cover of the third choice. It shows a painting from the Süleymaniye, a pictorial biography of Suleiman the Magnificent. He was the Ottoman Suleiman in the early 1500s. This wonderful collection of paintings has some magnificent images, but this one is especially moving and interesting. It shows the devşirme, or collection of Christian children. The Turks would regularly round up Christian boys, forcibly Islamicize them and enslave them. Some were sold in the slave markets, and others became soldiers of the Sultan, the Janissaries. And in this picture, a Janissary himself is collecting the children and speaking to a woman and an Orthodox priest. Whilst there are a few men in the crowd, there are a number of distressed women watching the scene of their boys being taken. Now this picture, a very moving picture, is set somewhere in the Balkans. It reflects back to us the history of the Serbs, the Albanians, the Greeks, the Armenians under Turkish occupation. It reflects a history of decline and demographic collapse, and today enduring religious and political tensions. However, and this is the central theme of this book, in exposing the pain of past generations, in telling the truth, we are not surrendering to despair or bitterness. Just because we don't know what the answer is, doesn't mean we can't face the truth. Osama bin Laden proposed that the doctrine of the three choices, which he, by the way, endorses, is the whole reason, he said, for the conflict between the West and Islam. He said, the West avenges itself against Islam for giving infidels but three choices. Well, I think there are better choices to be made, more positive ones than Osama's expectation of conflict and retribution. My deep conviction is that the core challenges of reconciliation and spiritual healing which are so desperately needed in connection with the age-old and ever-present dimmer system can only be met by combining truth and grace together. A life shaped by grace without truth will fail in self-deception and vulnerability. A life guided by truth without grace can descend into vengeance and bitterness. We should not be afraid of the wounds of the past, because only in opening them up to the light of day can we find true healing. Denial cannot be an option. We must not allow it to be one. As Archbishop Desmond Tutu said, those who cling to denial suffer from a crippling, self-inflicted blow to their capacity to enjoy and apply the fruits of change. The third choice was written to assist us all to make a positive change in the way we view the world around us. I am pleased to commend this book to you. It was written in order to challenge people's worldviews. It's an uncomfortable read. There is information there that is not available anywhere else. But I hope that it will move you to think about world events in a different way, and that after reading it, you will see connections between beliefs and events that you had not seen before. It offers, I hope, a worldview into one of the most significant political and spiritual issues of our day. It is truly an honour to be speaking here, and now I believe I'm open to questions. So I thank John for leading that.
We do have a microphone, and those that would like to ask a question, if you would just please raise your hand. We do ask the request, identify yourself and affiliation, if you don't mind, as a courtesy. Joe.
Hi, my name's Joseph Shatton. I'm with the Heritage Foundation. First, thank you for that very illuminating lecture. My question, though, is this phenomenon that you talk about, dimitude, this goes back centuries and it covers continents, and yet it's not very well known in the West. There have been many historians of Islam, you know, scholars. How is it possible that they all managed to overlook this? You know, until you came along and a few other scholars. It seems that this is such a salient thing, such an important aspect of Islam. Why is it no one discusses it?
I think people have discussed it. I quoted a source from 1799. There have been other historians that have written about these matters. Bart Yeor has written a number of books. Bernard Lewis discusses the situation of the Jews under Islam. But one of the peculiar things about those that write about the system is their capacity for localized denial. Bernard Lewis is a great example, a brilliant scholar. He accurately describes many aspects of the position of Jews under Islam. But he makes one claim. He says that Islamic or Muslim animosity to Jews was not theological. It's the most crazy and ridiculous claim. You can prove very, very clearly from the life of Muhammad and from the Quran that there are many theological, powerful theological statements about the Jews. How can someone so knowledgeable, who's devoted his life to understanding the subject so well, be so deceived about the theology? You could say, well, he's an historian, not a theologian. But that in itself is hardly an adequate explanation. He's a clever guy. I am constantly amazed by people's capacity to deceive themselves. There are many factors that create deception. One is, in the 19th century, the great powers were supporting the Ottomans against Russia. There were ideological reasons why they needed to promote positive regard for the Ottoman Empire and its policies. There were other subtexts running. Sometimes Jewish intellectuals used Islam's supposed good record of treatment of its minorities as a stick to hit the Christians over the head in Europe. Today we have other reasons for denial. I think this phenomenon, however, of non-Muslims not facing these facts clearly is a very ancient one. It's very interesting. In the Pact of Umar, which is one of the early examples of a dimmer pact, one of the conditions that the non-Muslims have to agree to is they won't teach their children about Islam. And in a sense, that idea that you're not supposed to deal with these issues frankly and openly is still affects us today. Finally, one more thing. My point at the end is relevant. We've become theologically illiterate. We're very uncomfortable with talking about religious ideology, and that's a huge crippling disability. And I think the radicals in the Islamic world know that. They sense that. And it's a great strategic advantage to them because we're incapable of engaging with the ideology that drives at least some of the animosity. So I myself am quite amazed sometimes when I read and I see the blinkeredness of people, their capacity, like David Khalili, is intelligent, capable, wealthy individual to say things that are completely and utterly false.
Another question?
Thank you. Very good presentation, facts. My name is Ali Al-Yami, the director of the Center for Democracy and the Human Rights in Saudi Arabia here in Washington, D.C. I want to thank John and the Heritage Foundation for organizing a meeting like this and Bill Murray for asking you to come over. We have done some similar programs with this group. I think the West know, the gentleman who asked here, that many Westerners do not know about what's happening in terms of Islam radicalism. Well, they know, and I'll give you an example. I'm from Saudi Arabia myself, and so I know what Wahhabi ideology does to its own people, let alone infidels. President Roosevelt signed an agreement with King Abdulaziz in 1945 about oil concessions. We'll protect you and you give us oil. He knows at that time that the Saudi ideology and promotion of killing non-Muslims, literally. They didn't say it in this language. The king of Saudi Arabia now says he didn't tell his people go and kill Christians, but he said what he's saying, which is the same, is Islam is under attack by Christians and Jews.
Yes.
We must defend it. Now, for a child who is already brainwashed,
yes,
this is means go kill them.
Yes.
So we are not ignorant. We know the United States especially, but the West in general, have been dealing with Muslims and Saudis for the last 60, 70 years, specifically in Saudi Arabia, where I come from. They cannot practice their faith. They cannot carry their cross. They cannot even wear cloth that represent their religion or culture.
Yes.
Yet we call them our allies and friends. So we know our biggest problems in the West, in this country especially, we are one thing arrogant to think that other people could do anything to us, even after 9/11. The other thing is we will do anything for money and oil. These are our problems. My question to you is, the Saudis have a tremendous amount of influence in this country, in our educational institution, in our foundations, in our think tanks, in our military, in our State Department, in Congress, in the White House, everywhere. How much influence do they have in Australia? And what are you guys doing about it? And what we should do in this room and other places? We heard your presentation. It's true. What shall we do to face, in my opinion, this dilemma, which will bring an end to the Western civilization, unless it is stopped before it's too late?
Thank you. It is true Saudi money is seeking to revive radical or orthodox conservative views of Islam all over the world. Australia has that issue as well. There have been cases where the government has refused Saudi funding. I wish our governments would say, you're welcome to contribute to a mosque in Sydney, but we'd like to build a church in Saudi Arabia. The line that needs to be used is to really educate people about reciprocity, that if you want to live together, you need to have some sort of equal basis. And that's a very difficult message for the Saudis to hear. One practical thing, many Saudis' embassies have religious attachés whose whole duty it is to spread Islam in the country that they are working in. America, I think, is probably an example. There are schools here that the Saudis fund, and they teach some quite disturbing things. Governments could follow France's example and forbid the Saudis from having such functionaries in their embassies. We don't do that in Australia, but we should. We could show more backbone, I believe, than we do.
One of the problems also is denial. A lot of our academic institutions have significant funding from the Middle East. I've been an academic, and I understand how you're dependent on peer review, research grants, and access into the Middle East and other countries for your own professional career. So we're suffering from the degradation of the academic independence of our experts in universities as well. That's a profound problem. I've known many students working on thesis topics who were very clear to me to say there's lots of topics I couldn't write on because I would never get through. And there's a kind of dimitude of the academy happening. I'm very pleased. I did this work as an Anglican priest because, you know, I don't care if some university foundation doesn't want to give me a research grant. I'm not dependent on it for my bread and butter. But there's a very serious challenge, really, to our freedom to even talk about these ideas. That's another part answer to your question. There is an Islamization of Islamic studies happening, and people will not touch on certain issues. They won't go there because it will challenge their funding. It'll put them into controversy with their colleagues. We are not as free in discussing Islam as our forebears were 50 or 100 years ago.
Dr. Durek, Bill Murray with the Religious Freedom Coalition. Earlier this week, in light of what you said, you had discussed the situation with Major Nadir Hassan. And in light of the reports coming out this week and your presentation today, could you give us your view of Major Hassan, what he presented basically out of the Quran and in his presentation to the military, and how he followed through with that, if he did.
Yes, Major Hassan, 18 months before the shooting, gave a seminar in the hospital as part of his psychiatric training, and it was called The Worldview, the Quranic Worldview, great idea, great term, as it applies to the U.S. military. And he uses all the right verses, all the classic verses that any authority in Islam would use to explain a particular worldview, based on the Quran, and one of his conclusions are that Muslims should not be asked to kill Muslims, that they would fear going to hell if they did, that if you sent Muslims, and he explained the fear of hell quite thoroughly, he explains the doctrine of abrogation, why the later violent verses abrogate the peaceful ones. It's just a picture-perfect presentation of, you might say, the jihad worldview. And his conclusion at the end is, please don't send Muslims to fight in places where they might be fighting against Muslims. And then he's posted to Afghanistan, and he does exactly what he said in his seminar 18 months earlier one would have to do if one held all those beliefs. When I looked at the slides that were posted by the Washington Post on their website, I understood every single point he made. I knew all the verses, the logic of it held together, and my comment as I read it was, this man is speaking about himself. He's making a cry for help. He's patriotic, but he has a higher allegiance. And what's really shocking is that the people that heard him were embarrassed. They thought, oh, he's a bit weird. And they did nothing about it. They couldn't understand the simple idea that he was describing his own religious worldview, and this could lead him to kill people. And it's that denial that's a problem. Now, those who were his superiors are apparently going to be disciplined, but the problem is the report has now come out from the Pentagon, which does not mention Islam, that makes the same mistake that his superiors made when they heard that seminar. It's actually an injustice to punish those who are above Major Hassan while still promoting the culture of denial at the highest level. And it's a serious problem. I think what you're going to see in the times ahead in the US is that on the ground, people will gradually become better informed. And whereas denial might continue because people have made deep commitments to it in building their careers and establishing their system of advisors, at the ground level, more and more people will accommodate themselves to the facts. What we're seeing, sadly, in the US is, in a number of areas, is a deprofessionalization through the degradation of analytical capacity. And that will eventually prove to be ridiculous. But the sad thing is that along the way, people will suffer. I feel great grief for the families of those men and those people that were killed at Fort Hood. They should be taking the military to court and saying, why didn't you pay attention to this man's very clearly stated intentions, articulated in a coherent, rational, theologically rational and clear way? Why can't we understand those ideas? We have to wake up, let our worldviews change. We have to let ourselves think in different ways.
Yes, at the back.
John Grazioso, no particular affiliation. This idea of denial of diminitude, is it just related to Christianity or traditional Christian countries? Because I think Thailand is going through similar stages. And I'm just wondering if, you know, even another Buddhist or Hindu country like India?
Well, the Indians lived under Islamic rule until the British destroyed that, the power of Islam, and suffered greatly from jihad conquest. I don't have evidence of Hindu dimitude, you know, the mentality of inferiority, but yes, they did suffer greatly under the system. Certainly there are many examples that have been given of both Jews and Christians undergoing this problem. A good example was the Turkish Jews who spoke out against the Armenian commemoration of the Armenian genocide. They, at the highest levels in Washington, lobbied against the idea that the Armenians should commemorate the Armenian genocide, in which a million were killed. So that's really remarkable when you see Jews taking that position, but entirely predictable. They have to take the side of the Muslims in Turkey. And one of my responses to this denial is compassion, not sense of revulsion, although it is disturbing, but these are people who have issues. Another example is the Palestinian Christians who have to take, particularly their leaders, end up taking a position that's very much pro Fatah or pro Hamas, you know, and that's quite sad to see as well. But I think it can affect any of the conquered peoples, really. These issues. I'm not so familiar with how the Thais are responding to their issues.
Hi, I'm Ashley Frohwine, no affiliation. You talked about Bernard Lewis quite a bit, and he's written a lot about these three sort of classical divisions within Islam between believers and non-believers, men and women, and then also slaves and freemen. But I wonder, in the course of your work in general, and I guess this book in particular, if you notice the first two factors, the divisions between Muslims and non-Muslims and men and women, did you notice a lot of instances of dimitude being particularly, say, unpleasant for women, and perhaps even at a systemic level?
Yes. The Dhimma Pact is a pact of surrender. And Islamic law explains that if the pact is broken by any member of the community or the tax is not paid, then you revert to the conditions of jihad. Now, jihad entails, it's very clearly explained, that the men can be killed and the women and children are enslaved. Islamic law explains that when a woman is enslaved, she becomes sexually owned by her captor. In fact, Islamic law explains quite clearly that if she's married, that's cancelled. The act of capture divorces her. So the Muslim who has sex with her is not committing adultery. It's good for his conscience. And now what this means, let me explain this, that what this means is that non-Muslim communities live under the threat of what we call a pogrom, but it's basically the restarting of jihad. Again, I explained the sources are very clear about that. The jihad is restarted if the community doesn't submit. And you'll see men being killed, women being raped, and enslavement. It's quite hard to manage enslavement today. But look, at a good example of a killing, for example, was the massacre of Copts at the Coptic Christmas just last week. What had happened, as allegedly, as the trigger is that a Coptic youth had sexual relations or perhaps raped a Muslim girl. This was a breach of the pact. That sort of relationship between a non-Muslim man and a Muslim girl is a forbidden relationship, so there's a collective retribution against the whole community. Now, you'll find again and again down through history accounts of significant attacks against non-Muslim communities where rape has been one of the main features. For example, in 1860, there was an attack against the Christians of Damascus. What had triggered that off was that the Turks had abolished the distinction between dhimmis and non-dhimmis in 1850. The effect that had is that the local Muslim clerics believed that the Christians were no longer protected by the dhimma. They no longer were redeeming their rights to live, you know. And so they began to preach, it's very well documented by Europeans who were present there, they began to preach that the Christians had gone above their place, they were no longer inferior and grateful, they were no longer redeeming their lives, so their lives, their property, their women were halal, they could be taken. And that's what happened. Children and women disappeared into the homes of the Muslims. Some were retrieved. In fact, quite a number of humanitarian agencies were started in the huge effort to help the Christians then in 1860. You also have abuses, which, let me explain quite clearly, are extrajudicial. They're not within Sharia law, but are a problem for Dhimmi communities. And that is the threat of rape. There are many accounts in the history text, and also if you speak with Christians or Jews or others who've lived under Islam, of a fear of sexual abuse. I've spoken with Pakistani Christians, they're very anxious about it. The cops suffer from women being abducted a lot. It's very difficult to retrieve the women. The reason why this happens, although technically it's forbidden by Islamic law, because the non-Muslim community is living under the permanent threat of jihad, which then brings into play this possibility of rape, the threat of rape hangs over the community. And this is known. It's something that is understood across the communities. Edward Lane, in the 19th century, in his compendious discussion of Egyptian life, outlines a series of curses that children were taught at the time, Muslim children, to denounce upon the heads of the Christians. And one of the curses is that the men will be killed and their wives will be ours, you know. And so this creates a culture in which there's a possibility of sexual abuse and it becomes realized. It's the same problem in where you have slavery, which produces racism and a culture of sexual abuse. If you read the book Black Like Me, the white guy who pretends to be a black man, he is shocked by the degree of sexual abuse that he's crossing that boundary sees between the races. If you have a culture at a time where it's somehow lawful for a white slave owner to have sexual relations with his slaves, then after slavery is abolished, you still have this culture of abuse that can continue 100 years on. And this is a very big issue for Dhimmi communities. It's spilling over into the West. In Denmark, in Holland, in Australia, there have been a very large number of rapes of non-Muslim girls by Muslim guys. It's completely against Islamic law. But it comes out of a culture in which there's a potential for this to happen if the Dhimma Pact is breached. The problem is, people in Australia, when there was reported in the paper there were 60 girls that had been abused in this way, how can ordinary Australians even begin to understand the relationship between this phenomena and Islamic law? We have to understand the Dhimma Pact. We have to understand the conditional right to life. We have to understand the concept of a pact violation. We have to understand the nature of the laws of jihad. We have to rethink how we understand religions. These are very, very difficult concepts for us. And so when we are faced with a serious social problem, like a higher than usual proportion of people, of Muslim men in prison for rape in Holland or in Denmark, we don't know why this is happening. But it's embedded in a history and a culture that goes back a long time. That's why the word dhimmitude is very important. It's important to understand it because you can get rid of slavery, but racism can still exist 150 years later. And the Dhimma was basically, its formal characteristics of the tax were abolished because the European powers dominated the Muslim world, although it continued in Afghanistan with the Jews till the 50s, till they left and went to Egypt. But even after the basic tax system and the legal status is removed, the culture of inferiority, the asymmetrical relationship continues. And what's happening today is that the laws of the Dhimma are coming back as part of the Sharia revival. Now, if you have a Coptic church and it's damaged, it's incredibly difficult to get permission to repair it. If you do repair it without government permission, you could be attacked and the church could be destroyed. It's happened many times. Why? Because in the 7th century, one of the laws of the Dhimma is that after conquest, churches and synagogues cannot be repaired. So this shows up in the laws of Egypt, even though there is no formal Dhimma in Egypt. So this system that I've described is incredibly far-reaching, and it certainly affects women living under Islamic dominance. That's the primary way that they are really in a position of vulnerability. And it's described by Jews living under Islam, by Christians living under Islam. They're very careful with their women. They try and keep them within the community as much as possible. I'm sorry, there are some subjects I don't like speaking about. They're quite painful. How can you talk about these things and not sound like a crazy man? But, you know, facts are facts. One of the problems in this postmodern world is that we think facts are sort of, we just make them what we want them to be. But these are very sad but painful truths that need to be faced.
If we have one more question, we've got time for one more.
My name is Alan Nichols, no affiliation. a two-part question. The efforts worldwide for interfaith dialogue, could you comment on that? And given the oppression in Pakistan and the cops in Egypt, the attacks on Christians worldwide by Muslims, do you not think it's the Christian church's responsibility to lead in this effort to educate people around the world to what you're talking about? That it's the church, the Christian church, that must start to speak up.
Yes, I think it is. And I have a passion to awaken the church. I'm a strong supporter of interfaith dialogue. I think it's wonderful to build relations. I want to also say Muslims are not all the same. They have very different beliefs, and many of them deny this history that I've spoken to. They'd be shocked to hear what I've been saying. So be aware of that. One of the most disturbing things about one of the Christian responses to the Common Word letter, which was written by Muslims of the world to the Christians of the world, was that it had statements like, we acknowledge, we feel that your letter was very generous, it said to the Muslims, and we are humbled by it. So it adopted this sense of inferiority and the generosity of the Muslims in writing the letter. So even before the dialogue began, those twin themes of inferiority and generosity were put out by the Christians on the table. There was no reciprocal statement of generosity and inferiority of gratitude and inferiority from the Muslim side. That was a terrible mistake, and it was written by people who knew Islam very well, but their mentality, like Bernard Lewis, was partly corrupted by it. So that's one of my concerns. Talk by all means, but understand first. Find out Islam, study Islam for yourself. Don't just rely on your partner in the Islamic dialogue to inform you about Islam. That's not enough. They won't explain these things that I've laid out in my book. There's no way in the world they're going to explain the kinds of things that I've laid out, even if they will accept it themselves. Muslims themselves struggle with denial about these things.
We'll do the second half of the final question. Thank you. We'll just take your mic.
Brian Gabe. My question relates to the moderate Muslim community, which we all hear about, and saying that that is really the future of Islam, that it's really only a small part of the Muslim population that is radical. What happens to the moderate Muslim majority group in the United States? Is there any way of getting them to speak up on these issues, to address these issues, or is their own internal guilt and lack of information just make that an unreasonable hope that we might have?
Well, there's such complex issues. There are Muslims and former Muslims who identify culturally with Islam, who speak out about Islam. Maybe we should pay more attention to them. I think some Muslims feel a deep sense of shame. It's very difficult to talk about things from the past or from Muhammad's life. It's very difficult for them. And there are deep spiritual prohibitions against them being critical about their own faith. Probably the best hope for many is that they just become secularized and enjoy their businesses and make friends and settle down. The danger for America is if you have ghettos developing in which basically the guy in the mosque is shaping the worldview of the children and passing on this, setting up the whole, building the worldview thoroughly and carefully. I say that as a pastor. My job in part is to convert people to the Christian faith, and we do it, you know. And part of that is to reconstruct people's worldviews, to actually help them think about the world in a very different way. And that's a powerful transformative process that completely changes people's directions in life. It's changed continents in history. And it's that process which is the most critical one. And you could be losing the battle in the mosques with the minds of the young people and only realize the full effects of that in 20 or 30 years' time, when they're already so deeply committed to what they've learnt and acting on some of those principles. I haven't gone into this, but there are some principles of what I've been saying here that are affirmed by the highest Islamic legal authorities in the world today, by the International Fiqh Academy of the Organization, the Islamic Conference. It's put out fatwas that embody and support quite a number of the doctrines that I've explained. These are not marginal principles on the edges of Islam or held by extremists. They are core theological issues within Islam itself. And finally, I'd say we should do everything we can to encourage moderate Muslims to speak out, to leave Islam sometimes, to be critical about it. What we need, frankly, in America and Australia is the ability to discuss these matters openly and freely without fear, without being afraid of sounding intolerant, being able to talk about facts in a serious way, not being afraid of how people see us. We need that culture of freedom, and it's worth fighting for. It's going to be very powerful. If we can achieve that, it's going to be a very powerful resource for establishing, working out a way forward in dealing with these old Islamic ideas in the decades ahead. Thank you very much for the...
We do have copies of The Third Choice available out in the foyer, and there will be time to meet with Mark out there to have them signed if you would like to carry on the conversation. We do appreciate your kind attention today. I'll return Mark's copy to Mark. We do hope to see you again here at Heritage in the near future. We are adjourned. Thank you.